It's a joy to greet you all again this morning in the name of the Lord. What a treasure it is to be in the assembly of God's people. The burden of leadership, the Mosaic paradigm of kingship from Deuteronomy 17, 14 to 20. Have you been entertained enough yet by the primaries and caucuses being held these days to choose a leader for the Democratic Party? Well, the game won't end anytime soon. From now till next November, we will have to watch this circus as people parade before us, trying to convince us that they have what it takes to lead this nation for the next 4 years. It is hard to take it all seriously. We have curious ways of picking leaders, don't we? And we have curious definitions of leadership. When we explore the scriptures for paradigms of leadership, we could follow one of two courses. On the one hand, we could look for narratives in which someone demonstrates remarkable leadership and then ask, what is it about this person that made him or her so effective? Or we could look for prescriptive texts that describe how individuals are to exercise their leadership roles. We could find many such statements in the New Testament, especially in Paul's pastoral epistles, but also in Jesus' teaching in the Gospels as well as in the general epistles. It may strike the citizens of this great republic as ironical that the most eloquent presentation of servant leadership in the entire Old Testament is to be found in Moses' instructions on the conduct of a future king for Israel, as we have it in Deuteronomy 17, 14 to 20. In this lecture, I propose to take a closer look at this text and to explore it in its original context, both literary and cultural, and then to reflect on how the principles of leadership prescribed in this text might be applied within the context of the contemporary church. I would like to structure my examination of the passage around three questions. First, what circumstances call for this paradigm of leadership? Two, how does this kind of leader emerge? And three, how should this kind of leader exercise leadership? In your outline notes that you have with you, I am skipping the first part, which tries to set in context this text, Deuteronomy 17, 14 to 20. You notice it comes right in the middle of five passages in which Moses is describing constitutional matters, administrative matters for the future. You have them there. This one comes right in the middle. I want to move immediately to answering the first question. What circumstances call for this paradigm of leadership that we have described here? Moses begins his instructions regarding kingship matter-of-factly with a lengthy temporal clause predicting the circumstances under which a monarchy might be contemplated in Israel. As in 12:29, and I have that text beside you as well, the opening clause beginning with key when anticipates a future historical situation. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it, and you live in it, and you say, three conditions. When Israel has entered the land, when they have taken possession of it, and they have established their residence there. This request catches the reader by surprise, since on the one hand, the previous chapters of Deuteronomy have never conceived of Israel as a monarchy. And on the other hand, the notion will appear only once more in the book in chapter 28, verse 36. Based on the narratives of Exodus to Numbers, no one in Israel has ever imagined the nation being constituted as a monarchy with a king other than their God, the Lord. Israel is a theocracy. However, this does not mean that the notion is absolutely new. if one assumes the antiquity of the patriarchal narratives, and I do, and their literary composition, which I do as well, the benefactions of God's covenant with the patriarchs included the promise that Abraham's descendants would become a multitude of goyim, which by definition are monarchies. More specifically, on three occasions, God had expressly promised the ancestors, including Jacob, that kings, Malachim, would be among their descendants. According to Genesis 49:10, Jacob expressly pronounced the tribe of Judah as the bearer of the royal scepter. And no doubt many in the present generation will have been familiar with the oracles of the pagan prophet Balaam, who reinforces this notion twice, predicting first that Israel as a kingdom and her king would be exalted, Numbers 24:7, and second that a star and royal scepter would rise from Jacob, that is, Israel. However, since the Israelites had left Egypt, no one in Israel had raised the issue. The present text offers no clues why the Israelites would want a king. Scholars recognize that in the ancient Near East, kings generally fulfilled the roles of warrior in the protection of society from outside threats, of judges to guarantee justice within, and as patron of the cult to ensure the right ordering of worship. Three functions of kings. With respect to the first, that is, leading the nations in battle, with the imminent departure of Moses on the one hand and the battles awaiting the Israelites on the other side of the Jordan, one might have expected a motive clause like we find in the demand the people presented to Samuel centuries later. Let me install a king over me that he may go out before me and fight my battles. 1 Samuel 8:20. More to the point, though, the present context envisions the people requesting a king after the battles have been fought, after they have dispossessed the enemy and have settled in the land. With respect to the judicial function, in the immediately preceding paragraphs, Moses has just called for the appointment of judges and other officials to administer justice in the land and assigned to the Levitical priests a judicial role, thereby taking the gavel of justice out of the hands of any future king. And with respect to the king's role as patron of the cult, maintaining places of worship and providing materials and personnel needed for the proper administration of religion, this notion is foreign to the book of Deuteronomy. As we saw yesterday, here the Lord relates directly to Israel, choosing the place to establish his name and establishing the cult without any hint of involvement from a king. In verses 16 to 20, Moses will explicitly repudiate prevailing models of kingship for Israel, which heightens the significance of the modifier. We let us set over ourselves a king like all the nations that are around us. Grammatically, like all the nations could refer to the king, in which case the desire is to have a king like all the nations have. However, it is also likely, perhaps more likely, that the phrase refers to the rationale for and the process of installing a king like the nations do. Accordingly, the request reflects not only the desire for a king, but also more fundamentally, a desire to be like the nations. The latter interpretation seems to be the way the elders of Israel who echo the present quotation understand the statement in 1 Samuel 8:5 when they demand that Samuel give them a king. But they expressly betray their true colors in verses 19 to 20. No, there shall be a king over us that we, yes, we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us. Now we notice from the book of Deuteronomy over and over again of the potential threat that Canaanite religious ideas will pose for the Israelites. Now we notice also Moses anticipates that Canaanite political ideas will also be an attraction. Although we might be suspicious of the motivations behind the anticipated request for a king, Moses' response is fundamentally positive. The opening clause of verse 15 is actually emphatic. You may indeed install a king over yourself. It's a permission granted. Unlike the appointment of judges in 16:18-20, which Moses prescribes, you must appoint judges. This statement represents a granting of permission according to the people's desire. That Moses should approve the request demonstrates that the Israelite constitution is not in fossilized form. It is not opposed to the monarchical system in principle. We can go that way if you want. Moses had enthusiastically opened the door widely in chapter 12 to the consumption of meat, where the request is quite similar. When the Lord your God enlarges your territory as he promised you, and you say, I would like to eat meat, Moses said, yes, go ahead. I am amazed at how positive God is in the book of Deuteronomy. He is far more willing to open doors rather than close them. And you will find that there as in our case as well. But here he begins then, following this permission granted up, with setting strict limits on the conduct of the person installed in the office and also the qualifications of that person. Let's look briefly at the qualifications of this person appointed for leadership. First of all, he must be chosen by God. Although Moses anticipates the idea for a king originating with the Israelites, he quickly restricts their freedom of movement in the selection of the king, specifying that the qualifications must be rigorously adhered to. First, the people must install somebody whom the Lord chooses. By now, the concept of divine election is familiar to the readers of the book of Deuteronomy. As we said yesterday, elsewhere, the verb with the Lord as the subject is applied to the election of the people of Israel as his people out of all the peoples of the earth in chapter 4 and 7 and 10 and 14. It's also used of the election of a place to establish his name, the election of the Levites as priests of all the tribes. And now he uses the same verb to speak of the Lord choosing a king from the people to govern the nation that is his. Now, the notion of divinity choosing a person to serve as his royal representative was widespread in the ancient Near East. And I could give you now quotations, citations from 18th century B.C. in Mari on the Euphrates River, in 2nd millennium B.C. Babylon, as late as 8th century B.C. Syria, 7th century B.C. Assyria, and 6th century B.C. Persia. This motif is ubiquitous in ancient writings. However, in this context, Moses envisions a chosen ruler governing the chosen people on the Lord's behalf. As in the case of the place that the Lord will choose to establish his name, Moses provides no clue about who that person might be or how the Lord would reveal his choice to them. That will remain a mystery until later. Second, this person is to be chosen from among the people. In verse 15b, he adds this second qualification. He must be a fellow Israelite. He makes the point emphatically, first, with a positive directive that he must be Mekerev Acheka, literally, from the midst of your brothers. And second, with a negative prohibition against installing an outsider, an Ish Nokri, defined more precisely as one who is not your brother. And of course, with this kind of kinship language, you recognize that in Moses' eyes, all of Israel is one big family. I was going to say one big happy family. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. But here, to Moses, the people of Yahweh were to be ruled by a viceroy of Yahweh, chosen from their own ranks, not an expert brought in from the outside. Which leads me then to the next point, and this will be my center of gravity this morning. How does a true leader exercise leadership in Israel? How is the king to conduct his affairs? Having expressed his fundamental support of the appointment of a king in the future, in verses 16-20, Moses turns his attention to the manner in which the responsibilities of kingship are to be recognized. Moses' severe circumscription of the Israelite king's powers is remarkable. He describes the duties of the future king in two parts. First, with a triad of proscriptions intended to prevent common abuses of the office that arise out of greed and ambition. And second, with an extraordinary spiritual and ethical prescription for the king. Let's notice, first of all, the danger, ambition. How will we guard against ambition in the monarchy, in the royal institution? Moses signals his transition to a new phase of his instruction concerning kingship with a restrictive particle only, except by no means at the beginning of verse 16. Yes, to a king, but, and it's a strong but, although there are four sentences, if you want to diagram this syntactically, there are four sentences. They actually may be reduced to three prohibitions. The prohibition on multiplying for himself horses, women, and precious metals, respectively. Let's look at the first. The lust for power as it is expressed in the desire for horses. In his first proscription on royal behavior, Moses prohibits the king from multiplying horses for himself. Now, horses were first domesticated in the Eurasian steppes and introduced to the Near East in the 3rd millennium B.C. Now, I grew up on a farm in northern Saskatchewan, and there were many days when I regretted that anybody had ever domesticated horses. They didn't like me, and I didn't like them. Now we live in Kentucky. Unlike cattle and donkeys, which were widely used in the ancient Near East for agricultural purposes or to transport goods, horses were used primarily for pulling chariots, fleets of which provided a great military advantage over foot soldiers when the battle was conducted, especially in relatively flat terrain. We know from Hittite and Ugaritic sources that horses were used for military purposes farther north. However, with a single exception in the Torah, horses occur only in connection with the Egyptians. Anticipating the temptation that surfaced later, not only for kings but also for the people, to look to horses and chariots as guarantors of security, in chapter 20 of Deuteronomy, verse 1, Moses will instruct, "When you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." You will notice that he adds an interesting proviso that you shall not go down to Egypt to get horses. Why does Moses warn against sending the people back to Egypt? Egypt undoubtedly was not the real source of horses. They would get them from the north. Egypt had got theirs from there as well. But it seems that the prohibition addresses the fear of the possibility that the king, as leader of the people, could reverse the Exodus and lead them back into bondage, thereby undoing the great salvific acts that the Lord had accomplished through Moses. Whatever the reason, Moses strengthens his statement by appealing to an earlier utterance by the Lord that the Israelites were never to return to Egypt. Now, we don't know where that one is. There is no actual reference, but of course that simply reminds us that the Scriptures are not a total record of divine revelation. God made many proclamations and statements to his people that didn't land up being recorded. And so I just assume that this is somewhere out there in that unrecorded messages of to Moses, perhaps. We move then to the second danger, the lust for status, as it is reflected in the prohibition regarding women. The second command prohibits the king from multiplying women in his court. In ancient Near Eastern context, kings would amass large harems for several reasons. First, and most obviously, a harem provided the king with unlimited opportunity to satisfy his sexual cravings with the most beautiful women in the kingdom. Second, since marriages were often arranged to strengthen alliances with other states, the institution of the harem enabled the king to be allied simultaneously with many outside rulers. And third, just as the male members of a royal court served as decoration to reflect the glory and the majesty of the king. Have you ever noticed in the book of Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar is looking for fine-looking specimens? Because they're decorations, they're Hummel figures in his court to make the king look good with all these beautiful men around. So also, the larger the harem and the more beautiful its members, the more impressed foreign visitors would be when they visited the king. In short, the primary function of the harem was to enhance the status of the king among international peers. Remarkably, the present text says nothing about these considerations. Whatever reason other kings had for amassing harems, we hear nothing of that. All we hear is, so his heart may not be turned away. And we have to ask, turned away from what? The immediate response would be turned away from the practice of idolatry. But I have a hunch that it's far bigger than that. In the light of what follows and in the context of the overall thrust of Deuteronomy, Moses' concern here seems to be defection from the Torah that he has been promulgating generally, and which, of course, would also involve Das Hauptgebot, the main commandment, you shall have no other gods besides me, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Third, there's a prohibition on wealth, the lust for wealth. Moses' third prohibition involves the king's excessive, ma'od, accumulation of silver and gold. Although he mentions only silver and gold, this pair of expressions probably functions as shorthand for wealth and opulence in general. In the broader context of the ancient Near Eastern monarchies and in the light of concern for the Israelite king not to consider himself superior to his countrymen in verse 20, Moses probably had in mind here primarily the accumulation of private wealth by imposing heavy taxes on the citizenry. Looking back on these three restrictions on common royal behavior, we observe that they address the three temptations that many have recognized as common to those who attain positions of leadership, even in our day. An insatiable lust for power, a lust for status, and a lust for wealth. And I just did a little bit of browsing in the library looking for books with titles like Money, Power, and Sex by David Stewart, 1965. Money, Sex, and Power Toward a Feminist Historical Materialism by Nancy Hartsock in 1983. Sex, Money, Power, An Essay on Christian Ethics. I forgot to put the author in. The Challenge of the Disciplined Life, Christian Reflections on Money, Sex, and Power by Richard Foster. Below the Beltway, Money, Sex, Power, and Other Fundamentals of Democracy in the Nation's Capital by John Jackley. Power, Money, and Sex, How Success Almost Ruined My Life by Dion Sanders. The Club Rules, Power, Money, Sex, and Fear, How It Works in Hollywood by Paul Rosenfeld. And then in 2001, Power, Money, Fame, and Sex, A User's Guide. Intriguing title. You will notice, I mean, these address all the big issues. And in a conversation with somebody yesterday, I don't know with whom it was, it strikes me that the people with obvious gifts for leadership are the greatest in danger, as you look at how this plays itself out. Now, of course, what is banned here is not a wife or a horse or any silver or gold. It is the accumulation, excessive accumulation of these for personal gain. If you look in the Hebrew, you will see for three times, for himself, for himself, for himself. And there's the issue. You see, persons placed in positions of leadership are placed there, biblically speaking, for the sake of those whom they are called to lead, not for their own sakes. Which leads then to the second major category of instructions for the king, the demand, submission. The danger is ambition, the demand is submission. The revolutionary nature of Moses' monarchic ideals becomes even more striking in the last paragraph of this verses of this paragraph. He expresses his ideals with three specific commands, all relating to the Torah. The king shall copy the Torah, the king shall have the Torah with him, and the king shall read the Torah. Moses' command to copy the Torah, to make a copy of the Torah that he is currently promulgating to them, is remarkable on several counts. First, It suggests that Moses recognized the canonical status of his teaching from the very outset, necessitating its immediate transcription to text and assuming its normativeness in perpetuity. He assumes right off the bat, this will be transcribed. And as chapter 31, verse 9 tells us, he does it as soon as he is finished. Second, the first charge presents the king not as one who writes the laws, but as one who receives them from a higher authority and is indeed subject to them. Though they will have a human king, Israel will remain a theocracy under which only the Lord, the divine king, has the authority to make laws. And it's interesting that at this point the text says, he shall copy the Torah for himself. He may not do these other things for himself, but now, in contrast, he shall copy the Torah for himself. What a contrast! Whereas Moses had earlier explicitly forbidden the king from amassing horses, women, and wealth for himself for personal advantage, now he declares emphatically, there is something the king must do for himself. And it's not for the people. We'll talk about the implications of this in a moment. Third, the charge assumes royal literacy from the outset of the monarchy. Many scholars continue to be skeptical about this level of literacy in ancient Israel. However, the invention of the 22-letter alphabet in the first half of the second millennium BC certainly made the ability to read and write more accessible to much greater numbers of people than Egyptian hieroglyphs and Akkadian cuneiform had. W.F. Albright used to say, once we have a 22-letter alphabet, any dumbbell can learn to read in 2 weeks. Furthermore, there is no objective reason to doubt that compositions as extensive and complex as the individual speeches of Moses preserved in Deuteronomy could not have been produced in the second half of the second millennium. And of course, this is where critical scholars are so skeptical. It's one thing to be able to read and write little documents, but could you have a book like this? Well, I think Alan Millard has recently demonstrated convincingly that that is the case. Fourth, the charge identifies the document to be copied as the Mishneh HaTorah HaZoth, a copy of this Torah, which I take to mean minimally Moses' second speech and maximally all of Moses' speeches within the book of Deuteronomy. The translators of the Septuagint, however, sent the history of interpretation of Deuteronomy in a wrong direction in the 3rd century BC when they rendered the phrase with the second law, Ta Deuteronomion Tutah, this second law. This unfortunate rendering is immortalized in the title of the book, not only in the Greek version, but in all English translations as well. I wish we would rather do like they do in continental European Bibles, Erste Mose, Zweite Mose, First Moses, Second Moses, Third Moses, and so on. It's much better than Second Law, because this name obscures not only the real meaning of the phrase in this context, but also the book's own title, Ele Hadavarim. These are the words. And it drowns out the fact that the overriding tone of the book of Deuteronomy is homiletical, expository, rhetorical, rather than legal. Fifth, Moses instructs the king to copy the Torah on a sefer, a document in the presence of the Levitical priest. He hereby provides the first hint of the priest's role as custodians of the Torah that Moses is proclaiming and will shortly transcribe. In 31:9-13, the narrator describes how this Torah will come into their hands. Having committed this speech to writing, Moses will hand it over to the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant and to the elders of Israel, charging them to read it before the people every 7 years at the Festival of Booths. The priests are custodians of the covenant and custodians of the Torah, which is an exposition of the covenant. According to Philo, the demand for the king to copy the Torah was motivated by a concern for memorability. In the act of writing, the words of the text are impressed upon the mind, lave, more indelibly than if the text is only read. I don't know how your Hebrew instructors do it, but I discourage my students from buying vocabulary cards. You need to make your own. Because in the process of writing on paper, it also gets transcribed up here. However, this was much more than simply a memory procedure. It is to be understood as a sacral act for several reasons. First, it involves copying a sacred document that claims to have been uttered orally by Moses at the command of God. Second, it involves copying a document that is stored next to the most sacred object in Israel's possession, the Ark of the Covenant. The tablets of the Decalogue were inside the Ark, but this was beside it. Third, it involves copying a document in a sacred setting, presumably at the central sanctuary in the presence of the Levitical priests, who serve not only as custodians of the document, but also as witnesses and guarantors on the Lord's behalf that the king would copy the whole thing, but also that the king would live by it. He would be true to the Torah he was copying. Copying the Torah is perceived here then as a covenantal act whereby the king binds himself to all that it promises and demands. He hereby declares nonverbally both his spiritual subordination to the priests and his subordination to the Torah as a symbol of the covenant that binds the Lord to Israel. Second, he is commanded to wear the Torah. The second directive for the king with respect to the Torah consists of only two small words, "and it shall be with him." But its significance is profound. In the ancient world of suzerain-vassal relationships, the vassal would receive a written copy of the covenant, which he then deposited in the temple of his chief deity, who provided oversight over the document. At stated intervals, the document would be retrieved and read aloud before the subordinate at covenant renewal ceremonies. However, the king of Israel is not to treat the Torah, which contains Moses' authoritative interpretation of the Lord's covenant with Israel, this is not to be treated as a museum piece, as something to be retrieved only periodically, or to put on the coffee table so that when your visitors come to your house, they can see there's this symbol of something. No, it is to be read. It is to be with them. It is not to be treated as a good luck charm, surely, but like an amulet, the written copy of the Torah is to accompany him wherever he goes as a constant reminder of his personal vassal status and as a guide for his conduct. I'm intrigued by the fact that in the book of Proverbs, this linkage between the word Torah and amulets is apparent repeatedly when the teacher tells the son, write these instructions, Torah and commandments, and wear them around your neck like an amulet. Well, here it has reference to this Torah. And finally, we have the command to read the Torah. The last charge to the king is the most elaborate and complex. It takes up the rest of verses 19 and all of 20. He begins with a simple directive. He shall read it all the days of his life. But this is followed by a series of four principal clauses which highlight the significance of this extraordinary royal duty. Whereas the first three identify specific responses that are dependent on the reading, the last announces the long-range reward. Even so, in all four statements, we hear echoes of earlier instructions to the people. And I don't have time to recite those, but for every one of these, you can see that Moses has instructed the people exactly this way already, and now he's simply calling on the king to be the embodiment of all that is expected of them. By incorporating echoes of earlier texts that applied to the people of Israel, Moses has reinforced the revolutionary nature of his paradigm for Israelite kingship. Whereas the kings of other nations often gained power by sheer Machiavellian force and at the expense of their rivals and their subjects, the kingship will be established in response to a democratic impulse with the favorable response of God. Second, whereas other states were often governed by foreigners, illegitimate usurpers from the outside, or imperial overlords, the Israelites were to be governed by one of their own under the imperial reign of Yahweh. Third, whereas the kings of other nations regularly used their positions to satisfy their own lust for power, status, and wealth, the Israelite kings were forbidden from using their office to amass personal power and wealth.
For, whereas other kings were perceived primarily as administrators of justice, a function they fulfilled by demanding absolute loyalty, the role of the Israelite king was to embody the divinely revealed standard of covenantal justice. 5, whereas other kings codified laws to protect their own interests and to regulate the conduct of their subjects, not themselves, the Israelite laws are codified by the Lord himself, interpreted by his spokesman, Moses, who has no vested interest in the kingship, and then they're imposed upon the king. This text allows the king no authority to teach or interpret the Torah, let alone amend it. He may only demonstrate its intent by modeling it. 6, whereas the kings of other nations were elevated above their countrymen with epithets like son of God and image of Baal or image of Shamash, in Deuteronomy, the former title, son of God, is reserved, applied to the whole nation, 14:1, and the latter, image of Yahweh or image of God, is absent altogether. This is also democratized in the entire human race. The only epithet the king of Israel may claim is brother to his people. The role of the king as model citizen in Israel and vassal of Yahweh is highlighted not only in the echoes of earlier statements applied to Israel in this pericope, but also by the way in which exposure to the word of God is presented as a prerequisite to life and well-being. Although no single text contains all the elements, the complete chain of events looks something like you have it on your paper. Reading produces hearing, which produces learning, which produces fearing, which produces obeying, which produces living. So you understand how important reading at the front end is for the last item in this chain. As far as this chain is concerned, 17:19-20 represents the most complete text, lacking only an explicit reference to hearing. However, since reading involved crying aloud, that's the word in Hebrew, and the king is to read the Torah for himself, it could be argued that this element is present implicitly. In drawing the link between reading and prolonged tenure on the throne, the equivalent to the people's long life in the land, Moses hereby presents the king as an exemplary Israelite and the embodiment of covenant fidelity. His countrymen should be able to look to him and recognize that if they imitate him, their own well-being will be secured. At the same time, the consequences of the absence of fear and consequent obedience are clearly spelled out in the covenant curses and blessings, specifically chapter 28. Some concluding reflections. Although we've spent most of our time wrestling with the BC meaning of this, its significance extends far beyond the original cultural context, even to the life and administration of the church today. Specifically, this text offers the contemporary church some extremely important guidelines for developing a theology of ministry, guidelines that run against the grain of contemporary perspectives on church leadership reflected in many of the definitions that we could give, and I have a catalog of them in the introduction here, it'll be in the notes. First, the paradigm presented here suggests that the forms of leadership in the church are sometimes determined on an ad hoc basis. While earlier texts anticipate a kingship, in this case, it is in response to the people's request. And so, it is approved. Sometimes we have this. And of course, for us, it will depend on how we handle this will depend on whether we adhere to the regulative principle or the normative principle of worship and church life, etc. Second, those who lead the people of God must be chosen by God. Now, the way in which the king will be called remains open. Presumably, since it was the people who initiated the request for a king, the identity of the person called will be revealed to the people, perhaps with a prior revelation to the person himself. But in Israel's own history, this election will ultimately lead to David. And when the text says, I have sought for a man, or when Samuel says, the Lord has sought for a man after his own heart, I don't think that has primary reference to David's character. The Hebrew word heart, lev, is used at least in 50% of the cases of mind. And I think in that case, the Lord has sought for the person whom he has had in mind all along. And Saul ain't it. It's David. that person as David. Just as the early church was led by persons recognized to have been called by God, so the church today must be led by persons whom the people recognize as called by God. Third, those who lead the people of God must come from within the people of God. The present expression from among your brothers assumes physical kinship, perceiving this as a large family. Translated into the church context, the leadership of the church must derive from among those who have been born again into this family, been baptized into the family of God, not from the nokri, the outsiders, those alien to the congregation. Fourth, leaders exist for the well-being of those to be led. Did you hear that? Leaders exist for the well-being of those to be led and are forbidden from exploiting their positions for personal advantage or selfish gain. I am troubled by the way search committees look for pastors because they typically appeal to all the wrong motives. You'll give you a bigger church, better salary, and all the rest of that business. It's fundamentally flawed. The temptations in the direction of using this for selfish gain may come in many forms, but the lust for power, status, and self-gratification and wealth remain paramount temptations. In the Bible, responsible headship is never about power or privilege. I do read the New Testament. There's some wonderful devotional material in Philippians chapter 2. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who had the inherent and native right to everything, but he gave it up for the sake of the people. Fifth, functionally and for the sake of the ministry, leaders may be perceived as the first among brothers, but above all, they must acknowledge their subordination to God. The king envisioned by Moses was to write a copy of the Torah for himself in the presence of the priests, who as representatives of God would hold him accountable for his personal conduct. Significantly, not a word is said about the person's administrative gifts or persuasive talent. Seven, before leaders can presume the right to lead, to teach the people the Torah, or to create visions of growth and destiny for them, they must embody personally the ideals of the covenant relationship to which the people have bound themselves. Ezra 7:10 is, in a sense, my life verse. Ezra set his heart to study, to apply, and to teach. And my brothers and sisters, it has to come in that order. Study, application, and then teaching. We need at this point to modify John C. Maxwell's favorite leadership proverb. He who thinks he leads but has no followers is only taking a walk. Leaders in the church had better start by taking a walk. And they had better be concerned primarily about the walk for themselves before they lead, that they might learn to fear the Lord, that they might obey the will of God, that their tenure might receive the blessing of the Lord. In so doing, they will model for the people the direct link between knowing the Torah and fearing the Lord and obedience, obedience and life. Paul has obviously grasped the significance of Moses' words when he counsels Timothy in how to handle the ministry. In fact, he may have had this very text in mind when he says, until I come, devote yourself to the, interestingly, now he says, public reading, to exhortation, to teaching. But then, and do not neglect the gift you have, which was given you by prophecy when the council of elders laid their hands on you. So it's not innate. You got it from somewhere else. Practice these things. Devote yourself to them so that all may see your progress. Not as a pastor in achieving 5-year goals, but personal. Keep a close watch on yourself and on your teaching. Persist in this, for in so doing, you will save both yourself and your hearers. And finally, while there have been a few leaders in Israel's history who have modeled the ideals of the Torah presented here, Joshua, though not a king, Hezekiah, Josiah, ultimately the role will be fulfilled perfectly only by Jesus, HaMashiach, the Son of David, who has come not to bring an end to the Torah, but to fulfill it in every respect. In so doing, he not only represents the climax of the royal meta-narrative underlying the whole Old Testament, but he also serves as the perfect embodiment of the ideals of covenant relationship as represented in the Torah. May the Lord inspire us all through the work of His Holy Spirit and the written Word of God to lead, according to 1 Peter 5:2, according to God. It's a fascinating expression there. I think it really is, as God does. Before we can do the tasks involved in church leadership, we must be paradigms of covenant fidelity and virtue. Leading with our lives before we lead with our ideas and our gifts. If we are not willing to say to others, "Do as I do," we have no right to say to them, "Do as I say." May God make us leaders after the order of Christ. Thank you.